All right, we're in Hebrews chapter 2 and page 8 in your folders, right at the top of page 8. As I put it here on the lesson, at least verses 5 through 8, personally for me, this is some of the hardest part of the letter. Maybe someone can help me if they don't see much struggle with this, and maybe I'm making this harder than it needs to be. But to me, this is some of the more challenging verses to properly understand what the writer is actually talking about. So we'll do our best to go through this together. I think the last part of the chapter is fairly straightforward and easy, but at least verses 5 through 8 is open to a lot of different interpretations. If you have a commentary that you like or some work that man has written about the book of Hebrews, you'll get a lot of different answers, a lot of different interpretations about it. So we'll entertain these thoughts and come to a conclusion, hopefully, as to what we think the letter's talking about, this particular section. I'm glad to see you. We have another good crowd out today. I'm glad Tammy's back out. I know she's glad to be here, too. She's been confined for a while, and we're thankful for her recovery. Freddie, would you lead us in a word of prayer before our class begins, please? All right, let's not lose sight of the outline that we're using. First two chapters, as we have it put together, give us the two sides, if you will, of Jesus' identity, His divine side, which we covered through verse 4, chapter 2. Finished that up last time. And now verses 5 through 18 of chapter 2 give us His human side, the complete Christ, if you will. And we are now at verse 5, and I think, introduced some of this a little bit last week. We didn't talk very much about it for the sake of time, so we'll just pretend that we didn't even get to it, and we'll just start at Hebrews 2 at verse 5. And since all of the material that I gave you, we can't go any farther past verse 18 because you didn't have what I just handed out to you before, so I'll not cover that. Let's just read these verses together straight through, these 14 verses. Buford, would you read for us, please, verses 5 through 18, then we'll start our comments about it. Yes, just 5 to the end of the chapter. Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Buford. Okay, again, in verse 5, and I didn't ask this question on the lesson sheet, but look at the beginning of verse 5, again, what is the creature or being that the writer mentioned that we just got through talking a lot about in chapter 1? No? Well, in verse 5, not to angels. We talked a lot about angels in chapter 1, okay? Remember that? Those quotations, how Christ is superior to the angels. So again, the writer mentions angels. Now, it was not to angels that God subjected the world, but to man. And we're going to talk about man here, at least through verse 8. And I believe this is man in general, not any man in specific, not man specified, not any certain man, but to man in general was authority or dominion of the world given. First, down through the first part of verse 8. In fact, as he starts in verse 6, I'm kind of getting to, this is the last part of question 10. Where is this quotation from, starting in verse 6? All right, which psalm? Number 8? Psalm number 8 particularly. What is man that thou art mindful of him, or the son of man that thou dost care for him, is how some verses will read. You have made him for a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting everything in subjection under his feet. You can go back and read the 8th Psalm, and that's a direct quotation from Psalm number 8. So, man was given, and of course, Bible students know, go back and look at the creation record, and it's not hard to understand and prove and connect from the very beginning, then pick up Psalm number 8, and then see the thought being made here in Hebrews 2, that man was given dominion or rule over the created world. Now, the tricky part, at least some will see, look in verse 5 again now, Hebrews 2, that this this was not given to angels, but it was given to man. That is, the world to come. And that causes a lot of confusion. What is the world to come? The writer says, and of which we now speak. We're speaking of this world to come. What do you think the world to come is? All right. Some say it would be the physical world. Because again, he quotes Psalm number 8. And you go back and you read that psalm, and I believe it is talking about the created world. Man has dominion over that. But would that be a world to come? Not from here. We're already in it. So, some would say it cannot mean the inhabited earth. In fact, I think some versions will give a footnote or a marginal note, may give you the literal reading of that phrase. It says the inhabited earth. I think the New American Standard reads that way. So that's one interpretation, that it's the physical world, but I struggle with that because it's not to come. I mean, we already are in it. I don't see any future tense in that. Others say, well, that would be eternity. That is the world to come. But will man have any rule in eternity? I don't think so. In fact, we can go to 1 Corinthians, and even Christ will yield Himself back to the Father. And Paul makes the point that all things will then be subjected unto the Father, and God may be one in all. So, I don't think it's that either. We're doing a lot of suppositions here. Some take, and this is the best thing that I can think of, and some take this view, that this is the gospel age. Now, it's not to come. In what sense? Well, we're already in that dispensation. That dispensation started when the law ended and Christ nailed it to the cross, and then from Acts 2 on, when the gospel was first preached, we've been in that dispensation. And in fact, as you recall, back in chapter 1 and verse 1, that phrase that Christ has now spoken to us in these last days, we're in the last days. But I think the argument could be made that it is to come from the perspective of the Hebrew audience. They were being tempted to go back to the inferior covenant. And does not the gospel age come in terms of time, come after the law of Moses? It does. The Mosaic age is before the gospel age in terms of if you would put it on a linear graph and look at it in terms of chronology. And so it is to come. I believe this is the best understanding. There may be some holes in this line of thinking either that someone may disagree. But I think we can see from the Bible that man does have some dominion in the gospel age. Now, of course, who has all authority? Well, Christ has all authority. He said so upon His ascension. So we don't have any authority apart from Him. But did God give man some dominion or some honor or some glory in the gospel age? I think we can find some passages for that. And I have them on the chart here. Let's look at the Ephesian letter just for a second. Ephesians chapter 1. So before we get back into the thought of the Hebrew letter here, I hope that we can look at some of these other verses and come to an understanding that this is what the Hebrew writer is discussing about man in general having dominion in this world to come. Again, the Hebrew writer says here in verse 5, that's the one that we're now speaking about. Of which we now speak. All right. In Ephesians 1, let's just read some selected verses. Bill Lambert, would you read for us verse 3 of Ephesians 1? Okay, so we have these spiritual blessings, and where are these blessings found based upon Ephesians 1 and verse 3? In Christ, but where's the realm? In the heavenly places. That's some spiritual realm. It's not here. It's this spiritual realm, and they're only found in Christ, in heavenly places. Now, keep in mind that phrase, in heavenly places. Let's go down to the first chapter and drop down to verse 20 of Ephesians 1. And let's continue reading. They'll read Ephesians 1, 20 through the end of the chapter. Okay, focus on verse 20. After Christ was raised from the dead, where did the Father seat Him? In heavenly places, at His right hand in this spiritual realm. So again, Paul makes mention of this domain or this realm known as the heavenly places, where Christ is now glorified, seated at the Father's right hand. All right, staying in Ephesians, now chapter 2. Let's look at starting in verse 4. Doing such a good job, they'll keep going. Ephesians 2 now, verses 4 through 6 for us. Now, verses 4 and 5 talks about how we were in sin. We were dead in sin, but God, who is rich in mercy, made us alive together. But based on verse 6, what did God do with us after He made us alive? We are now sitting together with Christ in those heavenly places. So that is a place of honor. That is some that is a dominion of sorts, is it not? It's an honorable place where we have some rule. Now again, it's not apart from Christ. Christ has all authority. But we have this place of honor now based upon our obedience to the gospel, our response to the gospel call. And when we answer it, God raises us up and puts us in this heavenly place, this realm, and we are seated together there with Christ. And then also, we won't read 1 Corinthians 3, but really the last part of that phrase, 18-23, Paul says, all things are yours, life, death, all these things are mentioned, therefore man's use. That again points to some kind of dominion or honor that man has. All right? So, I think it's fair to say, based upon passages like this, and there could be others that I didn't put on the chart, but man is to have some dominion or some place of honor in Christ, in the gospel age, in the world to come. That's God's plan. Now, he quotes Psalm number 8, and that talks about the physical realm. That's the context of Psalm number 8. But as a point that he's making, I think he's then making another use of it here in this passage and saying, this is what God had in mind for man. And I think that's the case the Hebrew writer is building here. He's talking about, first of all, this is the plan that the Father had for man in general. He desired for man to have dominion in the gospel age, in Christ, in these heavenly places. That was the plan from the dawn of eternity. But as we'll see in the next few verses, something happened. And it messed that up. And then he'll switch from talking about man in general to a certain man. And again, keep in mind, the context of Hebrews 2, 5-18, is talking about the human side of Christ. Not the divine side, but the human side of Christ. And we'll talk about the ideal man, the man, Jesus Christ. I think that's how all this will get tied together. Okay. You'll see there, now starting in the middle part of verse 6, there again is the quotation from Psalm number 8. Now after we get through quoting the psalm, back now to the writer's point. He says, now, in putting everything in subjection to Him, that is, to man in general, not talking about Christ yet, He, God, left nothing outside His control. God's plan is complete. Doesn't lack anything. It's not deficient in any way. But then the writer says, but at present. Now, here's the plan. All right, this was the goal for God. God's expectation, His dream for man. But it says, now at present, what's He say? We do not see, He says, we do not yet see everything in subjection to Him. Why is that? Why would the writer say, here's what God planned for man, but at the present, we don't see things as God had planned for man in general. Because man messed up. Well, God's not through, that's correct, but when did man mess up? When he sinned. And from Genesis 3 on, that was a blight on the plan that God had in mind for man in general. So at present, we do not yet see everything in subjection to Him. The last part of verse 8. Would it be fair to say that man's dominion was lost when he committed sin and rebelled against God in the Garden of Eden? Yes. And because man did that, I'm going ahead just for a minute, but I'm still creating this overall theme here. When man did that, what was going to happen for that to be corrected? He's going to have to be redeemed. How? Christ would have to die, which means He would have to come and partake of flesh and blood. And that's the last part of Hebrews 2. Putting on flesh. We've already discussed His divine side. Chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 4. But now we're discussing His human side of His character. And that's precisely what the writer is talking about here. This had to happen because we did this. The passage is there at Genesis 1, 26 through 28. You can see when the Godhead is talking amongst themselves, let us make man in our image, let him have dominion over all things that are created. See, that was from creation. And then in chapter 3, 17 through 19, when God is giving out the punishment, turn that passage real quickly. Genesis 3, 17 through 19, when God is punishing the man, He's already spoken to the serpent and to the woman. Genesis 3, 17. What happened to His dominion over even the land? What was the land going to be made to do now because of man's sin? Could we say that the land would be in rebellion to man? That would be a way to say that. Now the man is going to have to work by the sweat of his brow to try to conquer the land, to even tame it. Before sin happened, man was given charge of the ground, wasn't he, to tend it and keep it, to the garden. Genesis 2, that was verse 15, I believe it is, starting. So we would conclude that before sin, how hard would man's work have been? Compared to this, a lot easier. He still had to work, he still had to labor, but he wouldn't have had to fight so much the land like he did after sin. His work was made much more difficult. And so man had this dominion, but he lost it because of sin. And I really believe that's the point that he's making here when he says, now back in Hebrews 2 and verse 5, excuse me, verse 8, the last phrase in the verse, at the present we do not yet see everything in subjection to Him. Something happened to change what God had originally planned for man versus what the reality of it is now, and that is man's lost his dominion. So, we don't see, and notice the play on words here. At the present time, we do not yet see all things in subjection to Him. But then the first part of verse 9, what's the writer saying? But we do see Him. And some versions say Him. Most versions have the word Jesus in the text. So that's the Him we're talking about. We don't see man in general as he ought to be, but we do see the man. We do see the ideal man, Jesus Christ. And there he sets the tone for the rest of the chapter, talking about the human side of the Christ, the eternal Christ, who was to come and correct this problem that man has made for himself. We do see Jesus, or we do see Him who for a little while was made lower than the angels. That's a fancy way of saying what? Just one second, Bill. For a little while, being lower than angels. That's a fancy way of saying what? He became a man. That's right. Because man is lower than the angels. That was already been proven, wasn't it not? Back in verse 7, the quotation from Psalm number 8, men are lower than angels. And we see now this man, for a little while, being made lower than angels. All right, Bill. Yes. Yes. Being the ideal man. The point that Bill's making is what it says in Psalm number 8 here is applied to Christ in a meaningful way, being the ideal man or the perfect man, the man that will bring this problem back to its correction and have things restored again as God would want them to. So Christ is going to have to become a man for this to take place. And that, of course, is the theme, I believe, in these 14 verses, the last part of Hebrews chapter 2. So we're talking now about the ideal man, the man, Jesus Christ. In fact, the English Standard Version reads, verse 9, "But we see him who for a little while was made lower than the angels, namely Jesus." It just tells us who he's talking about. And now we'll pick up the last part of verse 9 and on into the next few verses. All right. Does anybody have any comments or questions down through question 11 on page 8? Anybody have any thoughts that we didn't cover that you had questions about? I don't want to leave anything uncovered that you thought would be important to discuss. Okay. So what about the ideal man, Jesus Christ? Now we're going to cover the last part of verse 9 through verse 15. It's a big section of text, but I believe it goes together. All right? The first thing that he says about the ideal man, last part of verse 9, is what? Well, what happened to him? All right. He was crowned with glory and honor. How? What's the writer say? By the suffering or because of the suffering of death. Now, in our thinking, we would say, well, that doesn't really give anybody any honor if they have to suffer and die. But see, we're dealing with the divine plan to save man, not the humanistic thinking. He was crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God, what about this ideal man? He died, or the writer says, that he might taste death for everyone, for all men, for all the men who have suffered since the Garden of Eden because sin was brought into the world. All right. God said, I'm going to send my Son. He's going to taste death for all men so that all men might be redeemed, since all men are now in sin. Since all men commit sin, we have to get that corrected, and that's what the ideal man did. So he was crowned with glory and honor through sufferings. Look then at verse 10. For it was fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory. So he brought many sons to glory. And that's, again, a fancy way or an embellished way of saying, we're going to try to restore this lost dominion that man was to enjoy from the get-go, from the very start. Sons have to be brought to glory, and that which we lost in sin, Christ will restore. That's just a basic Bible theme, isn't it? That won't be very hard to go through and find any number of passages that will talk about the fact that the death of Christ was to bring glory back to man because of sin. And so he says, bringing many sons to glory, that he should make the founder of their salvation perfect through suffering. Now, this version has the word founder. Richard, when you read that in verse 10, what did the phrase have? Captain. Is there any other translation that has a word other than founder or captain? Author, all right. The author, founder, captain. Leader is the, all those would be synonyms. And he is the author, the founder, the captain of what? Salvation. All right? He's made perfect, again, through what? Through suffering. So there's the idea, again, that we're talking about here. He was crowned with glory and honor through his suffering, and he brought many sons to glory through his suffering. And he is man's captain, leader, founder, author. There's the phrases where that's used. This word is found only four times in the New Testament. This word captain or author. Here's the other three right here. The first one we'll look at is in the 12th chapter of this same book. Look at Hebrews 12 and verse 2. We'll come to this obviously much later. After talking about these witnesses from chapter 11, all those who did what they did by faith, and that's the witnesses there in verse 1 of Hebrews 12. The writer says, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely. Let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the author, or founder or finisher of our faith. There's the same word, author or founder. And then in Acts chapter 3, verse 15 and 5:31, in both places, when the gospel is being preached, Peter for the second time in Acts 3, and also there in Acts chapter 5, you see the word prince in the text. That's the same word, the prince of life. It's the same idea here as the captain, the leader, the author, the founder. He's referred to as the prince of life in those two places. So here's man in general, here's his leader, Christ. And he came to restore that which we lost through sin. He wants to bring us back to glory, bring many sons back to glory. And to do that, as the writer will say in the next few verses, he had to taste death for everyone. Now, I want you to think just for a moment about this. Here we are in this pitiful state that we're in because of sin. And somebody's going to come to our rescue. He's our leader, our captain, we're supposed to follow him. If we were given the chance to devise the plan for our own rescue, let's just pretend for the moment that we were allowed to do that. Do you think we would work it out so that the one who is to come and rescue us would die for us? You think we would choose that? Probably not. Yes, we want him to do some great heroic thing, which I'm not saying that the death of Christ was not heroic, it was, but if we just would rely only or solely on carnal human wisdom, we wouldn't pick this means. And again, that just shows us how the wisdom of God is far greater than the wisdom of man. Yes, they wanted a Messiah, but they didn't want this kind of leader. That's right. The Jews wanted someone to bring back the glory of the kingdom of Solomon and David. And that's the kind of leader we want. And if we're looking for that kind of Jesus, what's going to happen? We're going to be disappointed. Sadly, sadly disappointed. Yes. Yes. To willingly die. That's right. Not just fall in battle, accidentally get shot. No, but to willingly die. See, that tells us the depth to which man had fallen when he lost this dominion. And the plan that God set in motion to bring sons, us, the sons of men back to glory, it had to be through the death of Christ. That's correct. The death would be meaningless had he not been raised from the dead, is Bill's point, and that's true. Yes, he had to die. But what if the tomb is still occupied? Then it's a meaningless death. And we're still in the same shape that we were in, still being sin. Yes, the first gospel sermon. Yes, God raised him from the dead. You are correct. So, yes, people still look for the Messiah. They do not see Jesus as the fruition of the messianic promises, but they've missed it. Yes, one. Yes. Exactly right. Yes. Wanda's point is very good. And we'll get to Satan in this passage just in a moment. No doubt Satan thought when he killed Jesus, that's the end of that. But I don't say he fell into God's trap, but he certainly was fulfilling the plan that God had in mind all along. And the comments that the writer will make about Satan in a moment certainly bear out what you're saying. Satan was just going along, well, not willingly, but what he did in having Jesus killed and murdered certainly fulfilled the plan of God that God ordained from the foundation of the world. Good comments, and we'll especially come to the to the Satan here in about a couple of verses from now. Okay, so the ideal man is one who will restore this glory back to fallen man in general. And through that, he will be crowned, which he was, and he will bring many sons to glory, and he becomes our captain or our leader because of what he did on the cross. Now, starting in verse 11, the writer says then, all right, for he who sanctifies and those who are sanctified. Now, who is the he who sanctifies? That's the ideal man. That's the Christ. All right? And who is those who are sanctified? That'd be us, those who, for whom he dies. Now, notice what is happening here. In this verse, he connects us all together. The ideal man who is the captain, the leader of our salvation, the one who came down to die, and the one for whom he is dying, he says, all have the same origin. And because of that, the ideal man is not ashamed to do what? To call us his brethren. Now, there's an honor for us. See, he's trying to restore this honor, this dominion that we lost in sin, is trying to be recaptured and reinstated. And then as proof of this, where does he quote? The early chapters are heavy in the quotations of the Psalms. They're just all over the place. Psalm 22, and verse 22 is a quotation here in verse 12, saying, after he says, that is why he is not ashamed to call them brethren or brothers, saying, I will tell of your name to my brethren, and in the midst of the congregation I will sing thy praise. And again, verse 13, quoting Isaiah chapter 8, I will put my trust in him. And again, the last part of verse 13 quotes Isaiah 8 also. Behold, I and the children of God, behold, I and the children God has given me. So these are real short quotations to emphasize the fact that he acknowledges us, he confesses us, he calls us his brethren based upon what he did. Now, if Jesus hadn't come down and become a man, would this have taken place? No. See, if we just left it alone from Hebrews 1:1 through Hebrews 2, verse 4, at the divine side of Christ that we covered, well, that's his eternal state. But if this hadn't taken place, we couldn't be called his brethren. And nor could what have happened about the sin problem. Yeah, we'd still be in it. We would still have it. That's right. You. Yes, and he talks about being flesh and blood just in a moment. That's right. But he was made entirely human. That's the point. There's not one part of being human that Christ did not experience other than committing sin. He didn't sin, but save that. Every facet of being a man, Jesus experienced. Of course, even being tempted. Tempted as we are. Which we'll see that, of course, the very familiar phrase in chapter 4. Yet without sin. Okay. Now, let me catch up here with my sheet. See where I am here. This takes us, I think, down through question 14. Toward the bottom of page 8 there. He is the sanctifier. And by the way, what does sanctify mean? That which is set apart? Okay. For a holy purpose, that's right. He is the sanctifier. We are the sanctified. We're set apart by His death. He shares in flesh and blood with us. This gets down to the point that Buford was making just a moment ago. After quoting these Psalms, we start now in verse 14. Excuse me. Since therefore, now what does man in general share? Despite your gender, despite your age, despite your upbringing, despite your socioeconomic background, all that put aside, what does man in general share? Flesh and blood, that's right. Verse 14. Since therefore the children, that is, these ones whom Christ is not ashamed to call his brethren, Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, and we do, he himself likewise also partook of the same. He became flesh and blood. Then he tells us why. Why did he do that? The last part of verse 14. Yeah. He had to take on human form so that he could die. So that through death, he might destroy, some versions say render powerless. He might destroy the one who has the power of death. There we go, Wanda. That is the devil. Now he mentions the devil. So this is why Christ partook of a human side, if you will. He shares in flesh and blood. Now, look at verses 14 and 15. Here's two reasons why, given in the text, two reasons why Christ took on flesh. Let's take them in order. Verse 14, what's the first reason? All right? That he might destroy the works of the devil. Or destroy him who had the power of death. That is the devil. Now, hold your place here. Turn to 1 John 3 and verse 8. This is a good parallel passage. Perhaps the marginal note in your Bible points you to this place. If not, you could make your own note. 1 John 3. Let's see. Let's start. Let's start in verse 4. All right, Jenny, would you read verses 4 through 8 for us, please? All right, so there's a good discussion about sin, how you live. If you practice evil, you're of the devil. If you practice righteousness, you're of God. The key here is verse 8. This version reads, whoever makes a practice of sin. Now, that's a good way to look at that. But sin is a way of living. It's not something that you're born into, like Calvinism teaches, but it's something that one does. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning, and the reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. Well, that's a good inspired commentary on Hebrews 2 and verse 14. So the first reason we're given in the text why Jesus died was to render powerless him, or to destroy him who had the works of the devil. Let me stop right here. Well, no, I won't do that because I've got that on the next chart. Okay, I'm looking at the thought question on top of page 9. We'll get to that just in a moment. All right. Now, what's the second reason why we're given the text why Jesus died? All right. To deliver us or to release us from the bondage of sin. Now, look at these passages that give us good, inspired commentary. Go back to Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 6. Let's read verses 16 through 17 and then drop down and read verse 23. Angela, will you read those for us, please? Romans 6, 16 and 17, and then also verse 23. The first couple of verses that she read, what's Paul talk about being slaves? Are we going to be slaves to someone either way? Yes. Either of sin, which goes to death, or of obedience, which goes to righteousness. But we're someone's bond slave either way. And when we're in sin, whose bond slave are we? Well, we'd be Satan's slaves. And that gets us to what Jesus, and the wages of sin is death. Now, the simple statement in John chapter 8 and verse 34, what did Jesus say on that occasion? The 8th chapter of John, and look at verse 34 with me. Ready, read that for us, please. All right. So those who commit sin, those who live or abide in sin, he said, you're a slave of sin. And so that's the quandary that we had. That was our dilemma. When we lost dominion that God had in mind for us, not only did we lose that dominion or that honor, but then we also became in bondage to sin. And so Jesus died to, first of all, render him powerless who had the power of death, that is, the devil. That takes him out of the way. But then secondly, then to deliver or release us who were held captive through sin, to grant us freedom or redemption or liberty, if you will. Yes, Bill. Yes. Right. He's a bondservant either way by free will. Sin is something that we choose to go into. And when we obey the gospel, we choose to become a bondservant of Christ. So there's nothing by compulsion here. You're right. It's entirely by free will. But obviously we can see that the second point here, being a servant of Christ in that sense, is far better than being the servant of the devil in the first case. All right. So textually, we have these two reasons why Jesus came and died. This takes us through the end of verse 15. Back in Hebrews 2 now. Look at the way it's phrased. Hebrews 2, verse 15. And to deliver all those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. What is there so frightening about death? It's the end of things. End of being a family. End of a lot of things that one would hold dear. And I'm going to ask the question. You don't have to answer, but I just want you to think about this, because I think about this a lot too. Are you afraid to die? Fear, death is the unknown, isn't it? Because no one has come back and said, well, here's what it's like. Okay? I've never been to Africa. It's totally unknown to me. I'm not sure I'd want to go, but maybe someone paid me a trip, so I might go over there. But someone can say, well, I've been, and I'm back now. Here's what you can expect. Here's what the land looks like. Here's what the temperature is. Here's what the animals look like. Here's what the people are like. Here's what the food is like. They could kind of educate me on that. But see, death is not a realm that one can go to and then come back and tell us. Who went to death and came back? Well, Christ did. And those who were raised in the New Testament by an apostle or Jesus, they died and they came back. But they didn't tell us what it was like, did they? Not even Christ had told us what it's like. So this phrase here, this is one of these great things that man is afraid of, because it's so unknown. Now, do we have to die? We have to die. Back in this letter, Hebrews 9 and verse 27. We have to die. But the beautiful thing is, based upon what Jesus has done, we don't have to be afraid to die, do we? We don't have to fear it. It's still unknown to us. And that's a journey, unless the Lord comes back first, that's a journey that we'll all make. But it doesn't have to frighten us. What if you're still in the realm of the devil? You have every reason to be afraid, because it is the ultimate end of all things if you're outside of Christ. Yes, John? Okay, two things. Okay. All right. Josh's point is that we do maybe have some idea of what awaits us because the Bible does give us some description of eternity, bliss with God, the writings in the Revelation, and that's true. That still is a descriptive language, though. But I was mainly talking about the process of death, what it feels like going through that, and then what happens next. That's what we don't know anything about. But your point is correct. Yes. The rich man and Lazarus also. Go ahead, Josh. What's your second point? I do that too. If it comes back to you, let me know, okay? I do the same thing. Okay. All right. Make that man happen, don't you, Josh? Yes, Craig. That's true. Except Christ. Christ is the only one who died and will not die again. That's a good point to make. Elijah and Enoch did not see death in the Old Testament, if I understand those passages correctly. And people like Lazarus and Dorcas and the widow from Nain's son, others like that, who were dead. And either the Lord or an apostle raised them. Yes, they did revive from death, but they did die again. You are correct. So his point here is, I think in verse 15, that when we were under the power of Satan, we had every reason to be afraid. And Jesus came and delivered or released us from that. So, now this gets to the question that I was going to answer a few moments ago. Top of page 9. In what sense was Jesus able to destroy, if your version has that word, or render powerless the devil? In what sense? Did he come down here and just annihilate him and take him out of the way? No, because we're still dealing with him. So that, it wasn't in that sense he was destroyed. Then how was he destroyed? He can't hold us unless we let him. That's correct. Yes, Satan no longer has the power over death, does he? He doesn't have that anymore. Now, you still have to die, and I still have to die, yes. But the consequences of dying in sin are no longer there. That's why I said we don't have to be afraid to die if we're in Christ. And all these passages here, 2 Corinthians 2, let's look at these real quickly. 2 Corinthians 2, verse 11. 2 Corinthians 2. Verse 11. Now, Ken, do you have that phrase? That's a passage for us? 2 Corinthians 2, verse 11. You want to read that for us? Just verse 11. Mm-hmm. All right, Satan uses devices. He uses schemes. And he tries taking advantage of us. And so we don't need to be ignorant of that. That's one way that we need to look at this. In Ephesians 6, the well-known passage that talks about the war or the battle that the Christian is in, look at verses 11 and 12. All right? Let me get my sheet out here. Who can I call? Miss Carolyn Miller, would you read for us Ephesians 6, 11 and 12, please? Yes, ma'am. Miss Carolyn. Okay, there's that phrase, heavenly places again. So, in this spiritual realm, not only is there the goodness in Christ, but also there is the wickedness of the devil in this spiritual realm. Now also, drop down to read verse 16 for us, Carolyn, please. So, in this passage, the devil has he has wiles or schemes. He has these flaming missiles or these fiery darts. So we're in a battle, see. And that's how we are fighting against him. 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, he's that roaring lion who's on the prowl, seeking whom he may devour. And in 1 John 5:19, John still writes that the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. So he's still active. He's not been annihilated, or he's not been nuked into oblivion that no one has to deal with him any longer. No. His destruction of Satan rendered him powerless in death. And I can think of no greater passage to illustrate this than 1 Corinthians 15. Turn there with me. You know the passage well, I know. You've heard it read at funerals. It's an awesome, awesome, comforting passage. 1 Corinthians 15. Let's start in verse 54. Wanda Baker, would you read 1 Corinthians 15, 54 through 57 for us, please? All right. Before I ask my question, let's go back earlier in the chapter. Look at verse 26. What is the last enemy to be destroyed? Death. All right. So when this great day comes, death will be the last enemy ultimately and finally conquered. Now, based upon what he's saying here, when corruption puts on incorruption and mortality puts on immortality, what's the phrase in verse 54? Death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? What is the sting of death? What gives death its sting? Sin does. And what gives sin its venom? Based on verse 56. What is the strength of sin? Law. That doesn't mean that it's law's fault. That just means when law exists, man knows the expectation. He doesn't measure up to it, then there's sin. So, the strength of sin is death. The sting of death is sin, and the strength of sin is the law. But verse 57, but thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through Jesus Christ. Why? Simply put, because He came and died for us. And that's the point the writer's making. This emphasizes in a grand and glorious way the human side of Jesus Christ. Yes, He's divine, as the first part of the book has proclaimed Him. But this is the practical way this has worked out. Jesus came and partook of flesh and blood that we might be saved from sin. It's a beautiful way to bring this discussion to a close about Jesus. All right, Brother Lambert, and then Buddy. Yes. This is one. That's right. All right, Buddy. Yes. 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 That is the when the devil brought sin into the world, yes, Genesis chapter 3, that is correct. And from that moment on, we've had to battle and fight this sin problem. And before the death of Christ, no redemption had been made yet. But when Jesus died, of course, that changed everything. Oh, yes, dear. Yes. Hebrews 2, verse 15. If we are released through... Excuse me. He was to release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. That's right. Yes. That's why I asked the question, do we have to die? Yes. Do we need to be afraid to die? The answer is no. If you're in Christ, it's still that unknown thing that we know nothing about, but it doesn't need to fear us any longer if we're in the Lord. That's just part of the journey, if you will, because of what He did, taking care of that problem for us. Okay. Great discussion here. Now, I think a good summary of verses 14 through 15, these two points to make. Verse 14 is one of conquest. Jesus came, He's the conqueror. He came and destroyed him who had the power of death. Now, the other great truth is in verse 15, it's one of liberation. He set us free, those who were enslaved to the devil or Satan, because he had the power of death. So you have conquest, you have liberation, and that extols the man, the ideal man, Jesus Christ. All right, quickly now before our time gets away from us. Verses 16 through 18 talks about the high priesthood of Jesus Christ. For surely it is not angels that he helps, that is the ideal man, but who does he help based on verse 16? All right, who is the seed of the offspring of Abraham? Who is that? That's us. Galatians 3 talks a lot about this. We are children by faith, or children of God by faith, having the faith of Abraham. So he was made like his brethren. He was human. He became a merciful and faithful high priest. Hebrews 2 and verse 17 is the first mention of this notion of a high priest and how predominant will that be in the Hebrew letter later on. It'll be a lot. It'll be a major, major theme that we'll talk about quite extensively. But this is the first mention of it, or the first introduction of it. He then says in verse 17 that he might be a faithful high priest, so that he might become a merciful, faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation. What's that word again mean, propitiation? So, satisfying atonement. Not just an atonement, but one that satisfies or pleases him who has the authority. So when God saw the death of his son, he says, that will do it. That will satisfy the demands that I have for the payment for sins. And then he also says he understands. This is why he is the perfect high priest. He understands God's divine side, doesn't he? Because he's divine himself. But he also understands man's side. In that he knows what? What does Christ know from our perspective? What it's like to be tempted. And that's how the chapter concludes. And that makes us think later on, chapter 4, verses 14 through 16. When he says that, especially in verse 15, we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. He knows exactly what it's like. Jesus is the perfect high priest, able to know both sides of this dilemma or this problem. Okay, anything else in the first two chapters? You see, there's a lot in Hebrews 2, verses 5 through 18 regarding the humanity of Jesus Christ. Any closing comments or questions? Anybody? All right, I handed out the next material. So if you came in after that was handed out, you need to see me before you leave because you'll need this for next week. Thank you for coming today and appreciate your participation.